I have to say, the shearer, and I have to apologize to a certain extent. I brought the larger sheets are essentially printed copies of Tanakh. They're definitely Shemot. So in this case, there is definitely Shem Hashem.
So
there's a box right here. Oh, okay. So I will take care to do it because the other ones don't. The other ones are. This is. Actually, you know, my Rav Shlomo Warman, who was in Kew Garden Hills, I asked him about, you know, what's the story with Shemo, because I print so much Shem Hashem. So he said, well, from a halachic standpoint, unless you're writing Shem Hashem with Kavana, it doesn't have to be Dio on Klaf, but if you're writing Shem Hashem with Kavana, that would be Shemo, and anything else like a photocopy would not. I said, all right, so you're saying I could, you know, throw away a photocopy? He said, no, don't do that. It's not Shemo, but don't throw away a copy with a... So there's a certain kavod area that's used. Okay, I have to apologize. I bit off more than I could chew, and as I usually do, so if I'm saying that ahead of time, I have to tell you now, it's a little scratchy of a shear because there's so much going on. It's a big topic. We'll talk about the Beit HaMikdash today. It is a humongous topic. I don't claim to master it at all. I'm not even sure to claim to have any expertise on it. At least I could say, you know, when I talk about Shlomo and about the political infighting, I could say, all right, you know, to a certain degree, you can attain a certain amount of mastery because the amount of material is, okay, a few dozen Midrashim, a lot of Tanakh. To master the Beit HaMikdash, I mean, you have to master Gemaras after Gemaras. You have to master Masechet Midot. You really have to have a full and total command, which I want you to know I don't at all. So what I'm going to do instead is just go through some concepts of the Beit HaMikdash and hopefully just point out a few things that people are not so familiar with and just sort of tie together what Shlomo did. It was really Shlomo's pièce de résistance, and I think it deserves a little bit of attention because there's some things going on in the Beit HaMikdash, which not everybody is that familiar with, and I certainly think that they're interesting. What I'd like to start off with is the Makor for the Beit HaMikdash. So the Makor for the Beit HaMikdash, if you take a look in Malachim, again, you can use the sheets if you wish. If you use the sheets, then it is on page, I circled all the sheets. So it is on page, let me find it. Yeah, it's such a big subject that while I was trying to organize the class, I simply couldn't. So I figured I'd just wing it. I hope it's okay with everybody. It's Malachim Aleph Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Dalid. So that would be it would be Pasuk Yud Aleph. It would be on page number 3, sort of toward the lower part of the page, right after the break. The last word is Arazim, and then it starts Vayihi Devar Hashem. So Vayihi Devar Hashem. This is after Shlomo builds the outside of the Beit HaMikdash. We haven't got into the Kalim yet. In Perek Vav, what he's built is the dimensions, the superstructure of the Beit HaMikdash. And we'll go into some details of that superstructure in a little bit. But, Pasuk Yud Aleph. So it's towards the... I'm on page 3. So if you... No, it should be page...
The top of the page,
yeah, and it's page 3. And there's an underlying portion... Yeah, I'm sorry, the photocopies are not the best because you have to squeeze the safer down on the photocopy machine. Vayihi Dvar Hashem El Shlomo Lemor. So he's built the superstructure, and he says Hashem comes to him. The insides of the Beit HaMikdash is built, so really he's built a shell. Vayidvar Hashem al Shlomo lemor, habayit hazeh asher atab boneh, which you are currently building, im telech b'chukotai v'mishpatai ta'aseh, if you follow my laws, v'shamarta mitzvotai lecha bahem, v'akimoti et dvari, I will keep my promise, itach, asher dibarti al David avicha, and we'll get into that promise. What will I do? V'shachanti b'toch b'nei Yisrael, I will allow my shechina, really. V'shachanti literally means I will settle in, or I will be there. But it's by no mistake that it also comes from the word shechina. I will have my presence, b'toch b'nei Yisrael, lo e'ezov et ami Yisrael, and I will not leave my country, leave my people. Where does it come from? It actually comes from Vayikra. That I didn't print out. If you're interested, you can either look at it inside or up there. It's in at the end of Vayikra. There is the bracha and the klala. for some reason, the brachas always tends to be a lot shorter than the klala, unfortunately. It is in Bechukotai. We've actually seen this before. We've talked about it a little bit, but I kind of want to, I guess, drive the point home. Vayidaber Hashem el b'nei, I'm in the wrong place. It's in Perek Chav Vav, Pasuk Gimel. Im Bechukotai telechu ve'et mitzvotai tashmoru v'asitem otam. So I promise you everything is good, and you'll have peace from your enemies, and your enemies will stop chasing you, and there'll be plenty of food, and you'll get to the point where you're exporting food, which is mipnei chadash totsiya, which means you actually don't need all of the food that you're constructing, so you're actually sending it out. So what does he say in Pasuk Yud Aleph of that parak? V'natati mishkani b'tochachem. I shall put my presence, really. So it's talking both about, you know, the physical house as well as his presence. Etc. Now, what's interesting is there, so this whole parak of Shlomo HaMelech is really connected to that promise. You can see from the word v'shachanti b'tochachem, which is similar. In fact, if you flip back to page 2, I hope, if I put it down, see if I did this right. Yeah, it got cut off a little bit. Wait, did I do this right? Oh, I didn't. I'm sorry, back on page 3. It's a little bit cut off. If you have a Tanakh, you'll notice that Pasuk Aleph is cut off. Starting the Beit HaMikdash, in the beginning of Pasuk Vav, Perek Vav, it's Vayihi Bishmonim Shana V'Arba'im Me'ot Shana L'Tzei Pnei Yisrael Mimitzrayim, from the exodus of the people of Israel from Mitzrayim. So again, that ties into the Perek in Bechukotai, because at the very end it says, I took you out specifically for this purpose. And what you should know, and of course we won't get even close, but as a study of Sefer Melachim, I actually heard Rav Halfgut, who is a big Talmud Chacham in Tanakh, who teaches in Dov Linzer and Avi Weiss's, Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rabbi Avi Weiss's Smicha program in New Smicha Yeshiva by Columbia. You need to, when you approach a sefer, he says, look at what happens at the beginning of Melachim and the end of Melachim. You have a conflict over who's going to be the king, two potentials. You have the building of the Beit HaMikdash. At the end of Sefer Melachim, because it's all one sefer, we could say Melachim Bet, but it's all one sefer for us, there is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and once again, there's a division between two kings. Most people tend to gloss over this, but it's really quite important. There's Jehoiachin, who is exiled into Bavel, and the people who are exiled into Bavel treat him as the king. On the other hand, there his uncle, who's Jehoiakim's brother, is named Tzidkiyahu, or that's what he's called, Tzidkiyahu. And he becomes sort of the other king, who's really supported to a certain extent by Yirmiyahu and the people who are in Israel. And there's this conflict over who will be the king. And it's that chiastic structure is done on purpose to show you that the Sefer is one. And what it should show you more is that the goal of making sure that you have a kingship is none other than to put God into a house, or in some small form. That's really the goal of Sefer Melachim. The goal is Lasot Chukot, the Lasot Mishpatut Staka, which of course is not only the king's goal, but God's goal, and it can only be done when you have a Beit Ulam HaKiseh, a place where people can be judged, which we may or may not get into later. Once again, once the temple is destroyed, that will lead to the same situation where the Melucha itself is destroyed. So the entire purpose of Sefer Melachim, to a great extent, is discussing service to God, and that's why you have this conflict over Bamot. You're thinking, what did Yerubim do so bad? He wasn't a bad guy. He built some Bamot, and there were certainly a lot worse, but everything really revolves around coming down to Yerushalayim 3 times a year. That's what it's all about. We tend to think that it's a political sefer, and of course the politics is important to understand how it affects the Jewish people, but ultimately it's a religious sefer. Its goal is to teach us that if you could get God, if you have a perfect situation and you establish Melucha, you could get God into a box. Once you have God into a box, the world becomes a messianic place, a place of peace and a place of prosperity. And in fact, that's what the point I want to get to next. If you flip to page 2, put together by a lot of people. But the first part of Melachim, probably up to the end of Shlomo's life, was probably nuts under God. After that, I don't know. I think it was written by a series of Nevi'im, but you want to know something? Before I say that, I think Yeshayahu wrote the ending part when it comes to Yoshiahu, and not to Yoshiahu, to Chizkiyahu, but you know what? I'm not sure, so I'm not going to answer that question. I believe it is a conglomeration of texts that were written by the Nevi'im that were finally put together at the very end. My guess is maybe even Ezra had a hand in it. But you know what? Since I don't know, that's pure. I should look actually in Gemara Baba Batra and see. It probably says. So if I have a few minutes before the end, I'll get back to it. There may actually be listed one author, but I believe if there is one author, what that really means is there's one editor who put together the text of the various Nevi'im over the period of time. Towards the end of, if you flip over to page number 5, which is at the end where the Beit HaMikdash is really already established, Shlomo makes a prayer. It's on the first column of Perek Chet on page 5. Vayamos Shlomo, the name is Be'ach Hashem, Neged Kol Kaisrael, Vayifros Kapav HaShamayim. He spreads his hands out. And he does this very interesting bracha, which starts actually on the next page, which essentially says, thank you for building it, and the reason why we're going to build it is for the following reasons. And take a look at Pasuk Lamed Gimel, which is about halfway down on the second column of page 5. There are a series of brachot. When these bad things happen to the Jewish people, the purpose of the Beit HaMikdash is so that we could turn to the Beit HaMikdash. Sometimes you're actually captured, and you're not in Eretz Israel, and then you will turn. This is where the original idea of turning to the Beit HaMikdash, it's written specifically. When you are in a foreign land, you will turn your eyes to the Beit HaMikdash and pray for redemption. So there's a series of brachot. Lamed Gimel is when you lose a war, but you're still in Eretz Israel. Lamed He is when there is no rain. Lamed Zayin, each one is a separate parshiyah. Do you see that? Each one is a separate break. Lamed Zayin is Shidafon Yerakon, which means after you essentially have no rain, you've got all kinds of diseases, and who knows what's eating away at your crops. If you go on to page 6, V'gama Nachri Asher Lo Me'amchahu, now it actually says a bracha that a guy should come. And then in Mem Dalet it's even worse, which is when you go to war in a foreign land and you're captured, over here it says that you should turn towards, take a look at Nun Bet, which is at Pasuk Nun Bet, which is at the bottom of the column of Perek Chet, first column on page number 6. Liyot einecha ptuchot el tchinat abdechavi el tchinat amcha Yisrael l'shmo lechem b'chol karam elecha. I don't know if that's really where it says it best. There, in Mem Dalet? Oh, that's good. Asher b'chata. Right, you turn towards the city. So this is, of course, the makor for turning towards, this is the original makor for turning towards Yerushalayim in this case. Now, what's interesting is, if you take a look, and I'm not going to go into detail because we could spend a whole shiur on this, but if we go back to Bechukotai, Bechukotai then starts with a series of, after that nice bracha about how God will rest in your midst, as that's why he took you out of Yerushalayim, it starts with the tochachot, with the bad things to happen. And you will not be surprised that those tochachot parallel exactly, almost exactly, what Shlomo was saying. Let me just read to you quickly. If you don't do those things, which is the first one, and then it goes, which is the second one. Remember the rain? So if you take a look down, they're all there except for the guy who comes to Eretz Israel. That's a new one. That's a shiur in and of itself. But essentially, the next paragraph that follows this one that I mentioned in Bechukotai, which mentioned Vishachati B'tocham, is specifically bracha for bracha, the same as Shlomo goes in and expands on. Shlomo certainly knew Sefer Vayikra, knew it very well. So he's clearly, I always love this, I said it many times, it's always nice when you have somebody in Tanakh being the first parshan, like a Rashi, for someplace else. So essentially, if there were any doubt about what's going on here, Shlomo is quite clear what these things mean, because he takes those simple 1-2 psukim, and he turns each one into a paragraph. So essentially being a parshan on Sefer Vayikra, which is very nice when you have one Sefer being a parshan on another Sefer. I always find that very exciting because it speaks to me about, well, first of all, it speaks to me about the totality and the homogeneity, really, of Tanakh as a whole, which sometimes needs to be done with all of Eric Frome's, Eric Frome, we used to always quote him, and he's a great guy, but I mean, he was a big mover of the Book of J, Book of P thing, and that stuff really needs to be made sure that people don't accept that. He goes this whole thing with Bereshit, which is very convincing about two stories until you read Rav Soloveitchik's A Lonely Man of Faith. What is it? A Lonely Man of Faith, where he explains why there are two stories of creation, and they're perfectly matched and aligned up. So it's this type of homogeneity, where you could see that a Sefer that was written much later parallels, and they knew about, and they were intimately familiar, not just with Sefer Dvarim, like some people would say, right? All they had was Mishnah Torah, because that's how they would translate Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah doesn't mean Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah doesn't mean just Sefer Dvarim. It means all the Torah, but the Torah that you have to go over and over. That's why it says Mishnah. So it's nice to see that Shlomo was familiar with Vayikra, not just Sefer Dvarim. And that, to me, I enjoy that. I enjoy very much these kind of things. But that's a rant in and of itself. So essentially what we have is Shechina. Now I want to get back to the Shechina because I want to show, some of you have heard me on the subject, about the messianic, about essentially what Shlomo had done is introduce a messianic state which is going to involve Shechina, or a proto-messianic state, but I'm going to get back to it. First I want to go to a few other things. Where was Beit HaMikdash built? So that's a question that I think that everybody thinks they know the answer to. The Beit HaMikdash was clearly built on Har HaBayit, except nowhere. Nowhere in Nevi'im or the Torah does it say that. It only says it in one place, in Divrei HaYamim. All we know is that David built, put his Aron with the Ohel on the place called the Goren of Arvana HaYavusi. Arvana HaYavusi, or sometimes Arona HaYavusi, was a non-Jew. He was a Jebusite, who was an important guy. He was probably, according to the Moshe Mefarshim, he was left over from the kings that David had conquered, but had mercy on. And Arvona HaYavusi was happy to sell David a portion of this land. And a Goren, by the way, we think of Goren, like when you drive through Pennsylvania on that long, boring ride on the 80, we think of a Goren as a silo, right? That's where they store wheat, these big silos where they store wheat. Back then, they didn't have, in fact, you know, I always, when I learned roots, I always pictured the Goren that both Boaz was sleeping in and guarding the Goren as this inside place. And I was always thinking as a kid, why not just lock the door? Why does he have to sleep in the Goren? So the truth is, what a Goren is a large flat rock, in this case the Evan Ashtia, and what they would do is they would pile up their wheat on it, but there was no wall. They didn't build a silo. There was no border. It essentially was a flat piece of a large expanse of flat rock so that you could put your Goren and pile it up high without worrying about being getting dirty, and so it would be a little off the ground so the bugs couldn't get so easy. But clearly, you had to sleep with it. You had to sleep with it. If you didn't want people to walk away, you had to sleep on the Goren.
Isn't Goren sometimes translated as threshing floor?
A Goren? I thought a Goren is a granary. Am I mistaken? Do you do the same thing in the same place? I don't know. Maybe you would.
Because you bring the wheat to the Goren, which is where you would thresh it.
I have to say, from the Mishnah, I know from Mishnah, learning in Maaser Sheni and in Kilayim, and in Truma, the Goren specifically is the storage place, because the din is that you're not chayiv Maaser Sheni until things are finished and it's in the Goren. So I know from the Mishnah's context, it's a storage place. I know from here, Evan Ashtia, I think it was also a storage place. And also, I think by Boaz, it would also have to be a storage place, right? When Boaz slept in the Goren.
You just said when things are finished, then you're
Maaser. Well, that's when you're chayiv in Maaser. That's right.
And
that's what they say. When things are in the Goren, then it's... No. I'm maybe misquoting the Mishnah. I got the impression, I could be wrong from the Mishnah, that the idea was once it's stored. That is, once you've finished your primary work of harvest. So it could be, you're right, it could be that threshing was done there as well. But certainly by Boaz, it was storage rather than threshing. Okay, no, please. This is good. All we know is that David brought up the Aron to the Goren of Arvana Yavusi, but nowhere, and we know it's in Yerushalayim somewhere, we know it's not too far from Har David, but there are other mountains in the area. So the only way that we actually know that it's Har Moriah was thanks to Ezra. And one gets the feeling, by the way, that if Ezra had to go out, normally, very often, these stories in Divrei HaYamim parallel the stories in Melachim. Sometimes you get a new aspect, but very often by these cases, it's really word for word when you look by. Except Ezra specifically added something. If you go to page 11, possibly page 10. On page number 10, right next to the letter A, it's in the second column. What is the Goren?
It's a granary or threshing.
Uh-huh. Good old Jim. It makes sense that it would be both. Where else would you do threshing as well?
No,
that's good. So it says in Devar Yamim, Vayachel Shlomo Livnot et Beit Hashem Yushlayim, the Hara Moriah. This is the only reference in Tanakh, believe it or not, to Hara Moriah. There is none other. And I remember, by the way, seeing a speech by, seeing one of the Shomronim talk about it. You know, the Shomronim were the famous, the Kutim were brought over, and they were Gair, they were Mitgair because they were afraid of the Aryeh. And I think they're the same Shomronim we have today, and they do Korban Pesach, actually, Korban Pesach. And they believe that Har Grizim, if I'm not mistaken, either Har Grizim or Har Eval, is Har Moriah. That's their Mesorah. That's their Mesorah. I get the feeling, but I don't know for sure, that Ezra, when he came back, realized after 7 years of Bavel, that people were starting to say, especially because the Kutim had come during that time, well, earlier from during Asher's period. But I get the feeling that after 70 years of exile, when they came back, people started saying, well, it's not here, it's not there, I'm pretty sure there's a mosque supposed to be up there, or maybe something else. One gets the feeling that there was a conflict, because it didn't, what? Back then, yes, I know, I'm kidding. That was just a political joke. Although what the Babylonians or the enemies of the Jews had built there, it's hard to say. A stable, for all we know. So, but one gets the feeling that Ezra, in the fact that he had to add something that seemed very clear, you know, like David or Natan did not seem required to say it all where it is. The fact that Ezra does, one gets the feeling that after 7 years of Bavel, it was not clear where it was. So he made a point to say that it was on Har Moriah. But honestly, this is the only way we know it. This is the only way that we know. Because it says here that it was with our with the Goron of Avana Yevusi. It should say that. What page was it? Number 10?
How do we know where Har Moriah is?
Right. All we know is that the place where the Aron of the Goron, Aron Yevusi, is also Har Moriah. How did we know where that was? Well, I'm guessing that for Ezra it was in Noadinim, like saying I know where A, B, J, and D is. You're right. Once things pass on and there's another galut, you probably get lost there also, probably just Mesorah. In fact, probably there are a lot of people in the world who say that it was not there and never there. But my guess is that from the fact that he added this specific item, Ezra, this was like a known symbol for Ezra. Whether it's a known symbol now or not, I don't know. But this is our Mesorah. But you're right. Even in that sense, we trusted Herod. Even Herod, you're right, just a Moshe Mi-Sinai. Oh, absolutely. That's correct. Also, we know it's close to Ir David simply because they were shuttling around the Aron when they were building the Beit HaMikdash. They shuttled the Aron to Ir David, so they're certainly not going to take it very far. It happens to be two mountaintops away from Ir David. There's Ir David, where most people, by the way, think Ir David is that when you go to the Afa Gate, so they've got the Tower of David and the David Museum. That's not Ir David. You have to go around the city to the right, then you go up a hill, and there's a yeshiva there, and there's a Jewish settlement up there. That's Ir David. There's another mountain after that. I don't remember the name. It's a smaller mountain. And then after that, after a valley, up is Har Abayit, is Har Moriah. So that's essentially the location. I'm sorry I didn't bring a map of close-up Yerushalayim, because it's nice to see topographically how it works out. So essentially, this is how we know that it's Har Moriah, and by and large, this is the only way we know Har Moriah. Now, I'd like to get to who built the Beit HaMikdash. So if somebody woke you up in the middle of the night and said, who built the Beit HaMikdash, you would say,
not me.
What? Are you saying don't wake you up in the middle of the night? What's that? that would be your only solid answer on the subject? Should we say Shlomo? And we would have said, if we had to choose the best king to build between you and me, if you had to pick the king of kings, the guy who really wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash and maybe should have had the rights to build the Mikdash more than anybody else, then it would be David. So the question is, why didn't David? So if you ask your classic student, a classic kid in any kind of elementary, they give the classic answer, which is, we actually touched on a little bit during the first class, which is Ish Damim, Ish Milchama. He had a blood on his hands. I remember the first class with Menachem Liebtag and Sefer Malachim, he said, well, I don't know, Ish Damim, look at Shlomo. Let's see, he was in business for about 2 days, and he had Yoav killed, he had Adoniahu killed. And don't think, as we've seen, Shlomo, we tend to think of Shlomo as not being militaristic. As we proved, Shlomo is quite militaristic. It's true that David did the conquesting, and David did the, and Shlomo built the maintenance. But to say that he was not a military type of guy, I think he was a much more military type of guy than David. Also, the interesting thing is, that comment doesn't appear in Navi anywhere. It doesn't appear in Navi anywhere. And what I'd like to do is, if you go to...
I thought he said,
That, oh, he does, but he doesn't mention the Ir Damim in Navi or Torah. It does show up once again in Divrei Hayamim, which is Ezra's view. Now, Ezra was a Navi, but Divrei Hayamim was not written by Nevuah. Ezra was probably, by the way, working from some of the same documents. I don't want to be imprecise on this, but Shmuel had built in Haramatayim Tzofim a house of Nevi'im. He trained them, he worked with them. I mean, we know this. These were his people. And there were a series of Nevi'im who were there, although most of them not famous enough to mention, whose jobs it was to keep the scrolls. You have the story of Yirmiyahu, the famous story of Yirmiyahu, where they grab a scroll and they're going to burn it. He has a student who, I forget the name now, it's been a while, it's in Yirmiyahu, it's not in Sefer Malachim, who goes to grab the scroll to make sure it won't be lost. Most people say it was Eicha, but it doesn't fit in right that was Eicha, maybe the first parak of Eicha. But what we see is that they're essentially students, like Gehazi. Well, Gehazi was a lousy student of Elisha, but he was a student nonetheless. So Divrei Hayamim, probably like Malachim, was put together from a series of Nevuah documents and then edited by a single source. Ezra had probably the same working documents to a certain extent. He also had Sefer Malachim, and he probably also wanted to add in something new. I don't want to go into detail about why Sefer Divrei Hayamim is different, but if you wanted to sum up in one word, Divrei Hayamim is more politically oriented. It's more what it focuses less on the religious aspects than on the geopolitical aspects. That's what Ezra cared about at the time. That's the message that he wanted to deliver. For Malachim, while it looks like a Sefer of Malachim, it's not. It's a Sefer of how to worship God is really what it's all about, through Malucha as a tool. So by and large, I mean, that's so making it so superficial that it's almost not even correct. But, I mean, that if you had to say one sentence, that wouldn't be too far off. So some things do show up, and that's the only place where it says Ish Damim. What I want to do is take you to the actual conversation that God had with David, and it is prima facie, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That's on page 1. David says, first of all, David in previous chapters has conquered all of his enemies inside of Eretz Israel. Eretz Israel is now Yoshev Betach. All of the people of Israel have come to him. He's made peace with the house of Shaul. By and large, you have a united kingdom. It would get worse, as I mentioned, over in Shimi ben Gera's time, and after the Absalom incident, it would get worse with the northern tribes. But at this time, there is real good, solid integration among the people of Israel. So David says, around David's time, I would guess about 12 million, just a guess, but that's just a shot. David sends a census, but we never find out how much it is. We have a sense of the people later on in Malachim. Cush attacks Eretz Israel with 1 million soldiers. First time we've seen anything like this. Revo shel Revo. We've never seen it in Tanakh before. So during Shlomo's time, countries are starting to build in the millions of soldiers. Figure a soldier is one-tenth of a population. A fighting soldier would be, I don't know, one-tenth of a population? I think that's about right, just in my guess. Maybe one-seventh of the population. So you're talking about 10 million people in Cush in Africa. With Israel being the center of the government, I would double that in Shlomo's time to 20 plus million. Again, I have no numbers, no proof, just my feeling when I read the text. That's the impression I got. I would put David at about the 10 million mark. It could be less. Could be less. Women and children, including women and children, old people, etc. What kind of standing army did he have? Probably a half, probably anywhere from 250,000 and in that range, I would guess, of a standing army. Also, the question is how many people were on the other side of the Jordan River? The problem is a lot of them were getting eaten up. Every once in a while, they were getting eaten up. Don't forget that things were running very well for Shaul for quite a while, and then the Plishtim attack Amek Yisrael, and they massacre Amek Yisrael. Hard to say how many people lost. But if it was in the 100,000, I would not be surprised. And the others scattered to the other side of the Jordan River, possibly to disappear with the 2.5 tribes. So because of the war situation at the time, I think the population was very liquid. Maybe the number I'm saying is too large, but certainly above 5 million. Certainly above 5 million. Why do you ask? I just want to get a vision.
Be a vision of, you know, signs, and as you talk about, you know, how big the Beit HaMikdash was, and how many people attended. Right.
The Beit HaMikdash? Well, yeah, and actually we're going to talk. I don't know if we're... Let's see how we're doing. Hopefully, I wanted to have dimensions. The nice thing is when I did this, I did a similar shear on the Beit HaMikdash in Or Torah. Or Torah has almost, believe it or not, for those who've been inside, has almost the exact dimensions of the Mishkan. The Mishkan. So you get a good visual. Literally, it's essentially as long, the Ulam. It's a little bit less wide by one pew, by one set of pews on the women's side, or I guess on the men's side, if you want to do it that way. It's the same width, and it's by and large the same height. So when you do this there, you get a really good vision. I'll try to do in this room, but I think this room is a little too wide and a little bit too short to do. But when we did it in Or Torah, it was very nice because we were able to do the Mishkan, and then I'll show you that the proportions of the Mikdash are directly related to the Mishkan, and I'll get to how they are, and then you can start getting a view. Maybe if we have time, which we probably won't, maybe we could walk into one of the ulams here, or this playroom area here, that's probably about, just as a guess, that's about the size of the Beit HaMikdash. Height-wise, it was 20 amot to 30 amot. 30 amot is about 45 feet. Would you say the ceiling there is 45 feet or no, less? Maybe in the play area here. Height-wise, how large? Maybe 30 feet? 30 feet. So take it up another 15 feet, and you have the height of the Beit HaMikdash. From length to length was 60 amot, or 90 feet. 90 feet. Then there was an antechamber, but forgetting about the antechamber right now, 90 feet would probably be about one length of that room to the other length of the room, would you say, or?
30 yards.
That's right. Not as big as you think. In fact, there's one weird thing. If you take a look at page number 2, if you look at the dimension of the Beit HaMikdash, you'll see something very strange height-wise. On page number 2, something should jump out of you automatically. It's the accepted. Do you see what's wrong with the Beit HaMikdash? What strikes you wrong? The picture on the bottom, the one on the top is the Mishkan. The one on the bottom is the Beit HaMikdash. You have the two pillars in front. I'll hopefully talk about those. You've got the Kodesh Kodashim, which is the one that's 20 feet high. You've got the Ulam, the Kodesh, which is 30 feet high. And then you've got this new antechamber, which was not in the Mishkan, which is 120 amot high. 120 amot high is a little weird for the construction. The reason why Shlomo sent for those tall trees is because you didn't have arches back then. Essentially, your building could only be as tall as the longest piece of wood that you had. There was no concept of arching that they developed in the Renaissance and probably even before then. It just didn't exist. Well, actually, they probably had in Greek times. This was pre-Greek times. They simply did not have that concept. So essentially, you could only go as tall as you could, which if you had a building that was 120 amot high, you would have to have a tree that was 120 amot high. I don't think an Erez gets 120 amot to be a stable, solid piece of wood. Maybe some of the thin branches get up that high. So there is in modern, I don't want to call it biblical criticism because I think it's correct, and I'll show you why. Probably the 120 was a mistake. It probably should have been 20, and I'll show you where that mistake is, because nowhere in Malachim does it state how high the Ulam was. It only states, nowhere in Malachim does it state how high the Ulam was, only how wide and how long. It was 10 by 20. Nowhere does it state how high it was. It states how high the Kodesh was, 30 Amot. It states how high the Devir was. The Devir is the Kodesh Kodashim. That was 20. But never does it state, what? A Namaz is about a foot and a half figure. Probably not exactly precise, but it's a reasonable estimate. Okay, let's get. I've jumped already into the dimensions, and before that, I want to talk about David. So,
where does the 120 come from?
What?
Where does the
120
come from?
It come. Should we do that then? You know what? All right, let's skip and do the dimensions. It's always been accepted that it's 120, correct?
Weren't the cedars in Lebanon supposed to be very, very, very tall?
Not 120 amot. I don't think a cedar in Erez. The 20 amot. See, that's another weird thing. If you take a look at the front of this picture, what's that? They would have to have redwood to pull together a construction like this. So I'll show you where it comes from now. But first, let me show you what's in Malachim, and then we'll contrast Malachim to Divrei Hayamim. It comes from Divrei Hayamim. That's the only place it exists. We put together the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's actually put together from three sources. One is Malachim, very incomplete. Another one is Divrei Hayamim, also incomplete. Another one is Yechezkel, believe it or not. But with Yechezkel, it's not clear if he's talking about Binyan Shlishi. He seems to be referring in many cases backwards, and he's the only one who gives us the idea of all the other things that were going around. A lot of the steps and the things that we know how to construct, that's only from Yechezkel. So in many cases, he is talking about the old one, but it is a vision towards the future. So Yechezkel is not the best of sources for that. It's not clear whether Yechezkel saw a reasonable Beit HaMikdash. It may have already been in incredible disrepair by the time he got there. So it's not clear what Yechezkel was working from, if not from Nevuah. So you could say, oh, Yechezkel was working from Nevuah. If he was having Nevuah, he was picturing the third Beit HaMikdash. If he was talking about what the second one looked like, he didn't need Nevuah, he needed blueprints. So it's not clear. So let's go to Malachim. Let's skip David HaMelech for now, although I think it's interesting, but let's skip to dimensions. If you go to page number 3, first of all, I already made a statement, something that you need to know. The word Dvir is a synonym for Kodesh Kodashim. Now, we say Dvir in Tefillah every day, and we tend to think of it as just the Beit HaMikdash. What's the, in the Shemona Esrei, the L'Dvir Beitecha, it's towards the end. Ritzei Hashem Lokei, is it Ritzei? Ritzei Hashem Lokecha, I can never do this unless I'm actually right in the middle. Ritzei Hashem Lokecha, L'Tefillatam, V'Hashevet HaVodah L'Dvir Beitecha, that's it. So you should know that it sounds like Hashevet HaVodah L'Dvir Beitecha sounds like you're doing Avoda in the Dvir. They were not doing Avoda in the Dvir. The Dvir was the Kodesh Kodashim. So let's take a look inside and see. And by the way, I kind of apologize. I know the style of my shiur is very different. This is really just a pokey shiur because I can't do the shiur real justification. So I just want to pick out certain things which are unusual rather than give you an overall comprehensive idea. So if you take a look at, on page 3 in the first column, it says, Vahakimoti, no, a little later on, it's about 3 lines up from the bottom. Vayivan et esrim amah. Vayiven et esrim ama habayit betzlaot arazim. These were the tzlaot, or like the ribs of the trees of the arazim. Min akarka v'yad akirot, from the floor until the walls. Again, I'm not actually sure what he's talking about. Vayiven lo mibayit ledvir lekodesh hakodeshim. The next sentence I think is more pertinent. Varbaim ba'ama haya habayit. It was 40 amot long. Hu heichal lifanai. That's the heichal, which is also known as the Kodesh. So if you look at your little chart, the top chart is also, on this second page, the top is not the Mishkan, it is the Beit HaMikdash. And if you notice, the heichal is 40 amot long. You can see it more clear at the top, where it's an overhead view of the Beit HaMikdash. Do you see that? Next pasuk, ve'eres et al bayit pnima miklat kaim upturei tzitzim, or various type of construction methods. Hakol eres ein eved nira, wood covered all the stone. You could not see any stone through the eres. Udvir betoch habayit mipnima hechin. They prepared essentially a dvir at the very inside of the bayit. Letitan sham et aron brit Hashem. So there, it's clear the dvir is the Kodesh Kodashim. There's no question about it. V'lifnei ha-dvir esrim amah ba'orech, esrim amah rochav, esrim amah komato. It was 20 by 20 by 20, which makes a perfect what? It's a perfect square, a perfect cube. That's right. As opposed to the other part of it, which is, hold on. Take a look at on. It means inside the lifnim. In fact, I would just translate it to the word lifnim, inside. I missed a pasuk, an important pasuk that was underlined on the previous column. It's pasuk gimel towards the top of the first column on page 3. Va'bayit asher banam melech shlomo l'ashem shishim ama orko ve'esrim orko. It was 40 width by 20 length, u'shloshim ama komato, and 30 high. So now we've got a problem. So if you take a look, as you can see from the bottom picture, I got 40 amot length, right? 60 minus 20 leaves 40 for the heichal. And plus it said that. So I got 40 on the Heichal by 20 wide. So essentially it's a rectangle. It's 40 by 20 by 30. And the Dvir is 20 by 20 by 20. So the first of all, it's short by 10. So there's a machlokan on what's going on. So in our Mesorah is that there was an aliyah. There was an attic from which they lower things in. It's a little bit weird that they're walking on top of the Dvir, though. It's like, well, walking on top of a grave. It seems not right. There are other opinions that it was raised by 10 amot and lowered by 10 amot, so that you'd have sort of a steps effect. But that's not our Mesorah. The reason why there are modern Mefarshim who say that based on archaeological digs of other similar structures, not in Eretz Israel, but in Jordan and in Syria, where they have this three-tiered approach or two-tiered approach where the inside sanctum is raised up. I would stick with our Mesorah, that there's an attic of 10 amot, and that's essentially how they dealt with things, because they couldn't go into the Dvir itself, so it was essentially a safe zone. And I think there's no reason really to say that it's, there's no compelling reason to say that it's otherwise. Now, there was an ulam. The ulam is added on, and that's different. That's 20 by 10, because it has to be 20. It's the same width, but it's a very short ulam, which essentially, I guess, a place, not a place to wipe your feet. I'm not, honestly, I'm not an expert. I don't know what they did in the ulam. And then essentially, you were out the doors. So one of the problems with saying that the ulam is 120 feet high, 20 amot high, is nowhere here does it say that. The ulam is discussed, but nowhere does it say what the height of the ulam is. We take by de facto that it was 30, because they said they built everything 30. The only thing that wasn't 30 was the devir, which was 20. So where do we get the 120 from? So here we need to go to, don't lose your place on page 3, because we go back to it. But if you flip over to page 10, towards the back, in Divrei HaYamim, it's the second underlined section. V'ha'ulam asher al pnei ha'orech. It was on the length. So essentially you have to turn around dimensions. Normally when you think of rochav, you think width. And when you think of orech, you think of length. With the ulam, it's turned around because they use the wider parts. What?
I was going to ask that.
That's correct. It's backwards. The only way to work it out is to understand that rochav always meant the kind of the narrower side to think of it. So when you think of the ulam, you have to sort of stand on the side. But you're right, the dimensions are backwards. And all the commentaries, by the way, the Rashi and the Ibn Ezra, they all come up with the same thing. Switch rochav and orach for the ulam. But here, look at this. Va'ulam asher al pnei orach, al pnei rochav abayit, amot esrim. It is 20 amot. Va'gova mea v'esrim. It is 120. Except I saw a modern parish, which I think is correct, because in every one of these numbers, we always have it preceded by what? It's 20 this, and 30 that, and 40 this. What is it? What's the word? That's the measurement they use? It's an amma. But if you look at the 120, it doesn't have that. It's rochav abayit amot esrim, va'gova mea v'esrim. So what the commentary said, and I believe it's correct, is mea and amma, the letters were mixed up in our translation, and it should have been amma esrim. So it was actually lower. What you had was devir 20, ulam 30, which makes sense, because you had to have stuff going on. That's where the lechem ha-mishnah was, that's where lechem ha-panim was, that's where the, you know, that's where all the hard duty work was going on, except for the sacrifices mostly outside. But the kohanim were busy and busy inside the kodesh. Makes sense that you'd want a little bit of height space there. And then the ulam was down to 20. The other reason why it makes sense that the ulam was down to 20 is because Yachin and Boaz, I can't go into what is the significance of the word of the Yachin and the Boaz. There were two pillars, if you notice, right outside. One is called Yachin and one is called Boaz. I can tell you what they mean. Yachin means established forever, and Boaz probably comes from the word strength and greatness. I can make up all kinds of homilies and all give all kinds of speeches from the pulpit on why those two things are significant, but I have no idea why two pillars were significant. They were certainly beautiful. I do not know. Certainly everything that Beit HaMikdash must have a Kabbalistic reference, and I'll sort of prove it later. I have no idea what they were. I'm sure if we really plow through the Midrashim, we should be able to come up with something which is near the truth. I have no idea what the truth is, but they were certainly Yach and Boaz, but they were very significant. But the most significant thing about them is they were 18 amot high. Then there was the fancy part on the top, which stretched past the 18 amos. So why would you make a pillar with 20 if then you had a building right in front of it, which was 120? You wouldn't even notice the pillars. The pillars would shade away. Again, it is acceptance in our Masorah that it was 120 amos high. But I have to say, and I don't usually like to go against Masorah. I really don't. There's a Masorah that we have, and breaking it is just... I was under the impression that Midot accepts it as 120, but I could be wrong. I don't know. I got the impression that this is sort of the... I know whenever you see pictures of it, there's always 120 amot high. Nonetheless, I have to say that convincing... I forget who it was. It was Professor something or other at Hebrew University. I don't remember what his name was. It was a convincing argument that Amma and Mea are confused, that there's no way he could have built 120 amot. It just doesn't make sense with the construction times and time. So what? Yeah, it just does. It works out so nicely that it's hard to. And again, I don't know if the Masorah is so. I don't think that, you know, it's not like saying that it's okay to murder. You know, like somebody from Hebrew University saying, you know, that murder comment, that was wrong. I mean, here we seem to have a Masorah that was 120 amot high. If it's not 120 amot high, I'm sure we will live. Hopefully, the new Beit HaMikdash will have a new set of blueprints. The interesting thing now is the comparisons. Look back at the Mishkan. Here you're gonna have to do a little flipping. The Mishkan was, take a look. It was 30 amot in length by 10 amot, and the dvir, the Kodesh Kodeshim, was 10 by 10 by 10. 10 high, 10 long, 10 wide. Also, a perfect cube. the outside was 20 by 10 by 10, which means that essentially what have you done? If you take a look, what does the Beit HaMikdash do size-wise to the Mishkan? The Devir is instead of, it's doubled. Everything's doubled. Now, why do you get the 30 feet? Probably the Mishkan should have had a higher also, but it couldn't because it was made out of Uriot. So you really couldn't get a Uriah, a cloth, to go like this, and then up, and then this. Probably if Moshe would have had his way, if it was reasonable to have a Mishkan that had an extra 5 amot, half the size, higher, so that it would have been 10 by 20 by 15. Somehow I think that's a magic number. And I'm using the word magic specifically because I believe there's a Kabbalistic definition. Otherwise, why keep the exact same references but double them? So essentially what you have is that the Beit HaMikdash is exactly double the Mishkan. And now here's the clincher. Shlomo's house, called the Bayit HaLevanon, and it's not clear whether some people say he built in the Levanon, but probably it was his throne room, which was his throne, where he had his seat of power, his throne, it's where he lived, and it's also where he had Ulam HaKiseh, where he did the Mishpat. The dimensions are twice the size of the Beit HaMikdash. It is 40 by 40, and I'm sorry, it is, well, you know what, instead of let me guessing, I think it's here probably on page 4. Hold on, where does he build his house? What is it? Let me see exactly what it is instead of guessing. It should say Vabayit Asher Bana Shlomo. It should be towards the end. I may have not photocopied it, so let me see if I can find it inside. It should be towards the end of Perichet. I could be wrong, though. It may be there as well. It should say that he built it for 13 years. I'm sorry, if I can't find it, I apologize. It should be here. Hold on. Vetulan. Oh, here it is. It's in Perek Zayin Pasuk Bet, which would put us on this page in... did I make a mess here? Perek Zayin, on page 3.5. Vayiven et Beit Yar Levonon, Mea Ama, it was 50, or Ko, V'chashim Chamishim Ama Rochbo, U'shloshim Ama Komato. So actually, it wasn't double exactly. 100 would be twice the length of... I'm looking at Perek Zayin Pasuk Bet. So he built it 100 in length and 50 amas wide, which would put you at more than double the width and double the length of the Heichal plus the Ulam. Now, so there's not a specific dimensions. I actually thought it was exactly double. I'm wrong. However, he builds his house larger than in Beit HaMikdash. So I read an article, also by a modern commentary, that proves that Shlomo was a megalomaniac. I do not believe that's correct. I think that's somebody who has something against Shlomo. It means that there's a lot more going on. There was the Ulam HaKiseh, there was a Beit HaMishpat, there was this thing called the Beit HaAmudim, we're not even sure what that was, and there was the hanging out quarters. So obviously you need something that's larger. What it does indicate, however, what you need to understand, though, in this Perek Zion, is that the house of house of Shlomo is mentioned in the same construction area. It says he builds the house of Hashem and his house and even Bat Paro's house. And that is mimicked in Divrei HaYamim, where it says God, there's a blessing to Shlomo who has established Hashem's throne and the Melech's throne. Because again, we've talked about this. The idea of the Melech is ex cathedra. The idea that the king's house is not also a house with a certain amount of Kedusha is not correct. The house is not just supposed to be a megalomaniac palace for a guy who needs a lot more space than the Beit HaMikdash. It's not. It's supposed to be an extension, albeit at a lower level, of Hashem's services through a human being. So I think that the dimensions are correct, although it's interesting that there's not a direct relation. I believe there was. So essentially what they've done is taken the Beit HaMikdash and doubled it. But now there's something else going on. If I were another thing, I wake up in the middle of the night and I say, how many menorot are there in the Mishkan? You would probably say one. And if I woke up your average student and said, how many menorot were there in the Beit HaMikdash? The answer is 10. A little known fact. Let's take a look inside. Everything is multiplied by 10. In fact, I saw somebody do the math and prove that the area, when you multiply all of the various sides together, is 12 times larger. He couldn't get it to 10, but he got it to 12. The Beit HaMikdash, that is the volume of space in the Beit HaMikdash, is 12 point something times larger than the
number of menorah.
Menorah in the Beit HaMikdash was 10. Let me show you.
But not in the
Heichal. In the Heichal, let me show you. Oh yeah, it's surprising, isn't it? It's nice, isn't it? I love surprising people. All right, let's take a look inside. All right, let's take a look. It is in.
What?
That may be. I don't know. This is certainly Bayit Rishon. I don't know about Bayit Sheni. I don't know. It's true. I don't know. Let's take a look at the kalim that are built. I believe that they are built in Perek Zion. So first of all, if you take a look at Pasuk Lamed Chet, page number four. Let me see if there's something also on page number three that we need to look at. Yeah, you know what? Let's just go. Let's start from the beginning on page number 3.5 on the second column, on the middle of the page, the Pasuk Chaf Gimel. We have Vayaset Hayam. They make a yam, which is a yam. Essentially, was this massive thing of water. If you remember, the Kohanim used the kior to wash their hands. Here in the Beit Hamikdash, I'm sure you now know how many kiorot were there. There were 10. And the yam is built specifically to be 10 amot in radius. The diameter of it is 10 amot. It held, essentially, it goes through it at Masechet Midot, it held enough water to fill up the 10 kiorot, and then I believe some on the side. So essentially, the radius, right? Hayam mutzak shem eser ama misfato el sfato, from one lip to the other. So it had a 10... Is that diameter or radius? Diameter. Mm-hmm. Had a 10 amot in diameter. Let's continue on. Let's jump a little bit further. It talks about what it was resting on. Go down to Pasuk Chaf Vav, which is the next block. Vayaset ha-mechonot. So first of all, nobody's heard of the mechonot. What are these mechonot? A mechonit, by the way, in modern Hebrew is what? That's exactly what these were also. The kiorot that they had were too large to be moved, and it was a large space. Again, think of the Beit HaMikdash as the size of that room. I think it's not too far off where the basketball court is. So you had Kohanim running around. You couldn't have stationary kiorot. You had to put them on a mechanism. That's what these mechonot are. Again, they weren't in the Mishkan, so most people don't recognize them. How many were there? There were 10, and they have a significant attribute, which I want to get to later. Let's flip the page. And what we have to page number 4... Oh, I see we're running out of time. Page number 4 is Lamed Chet, right in the middle of the page. It's after the first break on page number 4, first column. Vayasa asara kiorot. There's not one kior, there is 10, which are sitting on the 10 mechonot, which is no surprise. Now, let's take a look further on and see if we could find the menorah. What? No, let's take a look. Let's see. No, I see. I want to read it inside. I'll show you. Pasuk Mem Tet. It's on the second column. Ve'et ha-menorot chamesh mi'amin. There were 5 on the right side of the Dvir, of the opening of the Dvir. Ve'chamesh. They're talking about the Mizbeach Zahav. So again, you have one Mizbeach Zahav. That sits right dead center, right outside the Petach of the Dvir. On the right side of it, what do you have? Ve'et ha-menorot chamesh mi'amin. You've got 5 on the right. Ve'chamesh mi'smol. Ve'fnei ha-dvir. Zahav sagur. Ve'perach ha-menorot. The same exact types they had, they recreated 10 of them. One of them, obviously, is the original one. But they don't have just one. They're clearly 10, and they're clearly functional. Because normally, we think of the menorah like always being on this side, right? Because that's the way it was in the Mishkan. That's not the way it was in the Beit HaMikdash, at least the Beit HaMikdash Rishon. You had 5 lined up on this side, and 5 lined up on that side. And the truth is, for 2 reasons. First of all, practically, you had a closed space. Now, there were windows. There were windows here, but they were small. So very simply, if you have a Mishkan, which is 10 by, which is 20, by 10, by 10 high, one menorah should do you. It should do you. If you've got a space which is 30 amot high, 45 feet, I mean, picture that area, you need 10 menorah to be able to see what you're doing so you don't knock into each other and fall into the Dvir by accident. However, there's something else going on. As you can see, everything is multiplied by 10. Why is 10 a significant number? Don't know. Go ask your local Kabbalist. However, 10 generations from Chetzron to to David, there is among the number 10 a certain permanence, a certain Shechina, the Yud itself. What? A certain Sphira. There is something going on. The Beit HaMikdash was essentially permanence. It was meant to be the realization of God on earth. I know I've said this before, but don't think of Azara Kodesh and Kodesh Kodeshim as being holy, holier, holier. This Rav Yovanan says very clearly. It's holy, holier, you're in a different universe altogether. When you're in the Kodesh Kodeshim, you're not on the planet earth. You're simply not there. Everything is turned around. Everything is special. You're not allowed in there. And now here's the interesting thing. What was in what was in, also one of those wake-up questions, and I'm sorry I'm sort of nitpicking and stuff, and I'll finish up in just a few minutes. You know what, let me finish off the kiarot. If you take a look at the kiarot, for your own, if you want to take a look, I'm sorry, the mechoniot, these wheels, they had four sides, of course. They were square shape. And each side showed one side of, what? A nesher on one side? Don't you? I think you know where I'm going. A kruv on the other side? Is that where you're going? It was a shore on the third side. And what's the fourth one? Help me out, I forget. It was the, I'm sorry, the lion. That's right. It was an image of, it's actually the kruvim are changed into what's called anafim. They were just sort of a branch tree. They didn't want to draw an angel on, so they drew branches on it. But essentially what you had was you had 10 rolling Meiser Merkavot. Again, everybody really makes a big deal. You get books written about Meiser Merkavot. Oh, it was aliens. It was space aliens. What he was envisioning was, he was envisioning, among other things, not only the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and the people of Israel, but he was also simply remembering the things that he had seen. That is, before Yechezkel came up with the Meiser Merkavot, you had 10 little Meiser Merkava is rolling all over the Beit HaMikdash, keeping the hands of the hands and the bodies of the Kohen clear. So the idea of Merkava exists beforehand, and that will right here. Yeah, let's. Yeah, take a look at Lamed Dalet. Do you see? Va'arba ktefot al arba uberosha mechona. I'm sorry. Do you have the place? I lost my place. Yeah, I'm trying to find where it says. Oh, here it is. Pasuk Lamed Vav. Vayifatach et haluchot yidotea v'al mishgotea kruvim arayot v'timorot. Timorot are the fig trees which were supposed to introduce the nesher. They replaced the nesher that exists in the Meiser Merkava, the eagle. And then there's definitely a kfir here. And now I don't say this. Oh, here it is. Kruvim arayot timorot. So what's missing? What's missing? Kruyot, arayot, timarot, kimar ish viloyot, saviv. I'm not sure what viloyot is. I've got to take a look and see what that is, but I think that's the fourth image. And in fact, that's where I'll end the shiur, which is sort of on this and on Meiser Merkava as well. Because what you need to understand, and I did this a little bit when I spoke on Shabbat, he had introduced, I don't want to just say pithy things because I wanted to be able to prove it, but the God's presence came down from the sky just like it came on the Mishkan, and nobody was able to go into the Kodesh at that point, and they had to actually be makdish the area outside. What was introduced really was an incredible, miraculous event. The last item was what was in the Beit HaMikdash, what was in the Dvir. So if I ask a classic student, what's in the Dvir? The only thing in the Dvir, you would say, the only thing that's in the Kodesh Kodeshim is what? Is the Aron. And on top of the Aron is the Kruvim, correct. So the answer is that's not right. They built another set of Kruvim, which were 15 amot high by 10 amot wide. That is, they touch the ceiling of the Kruvim. These are massive structures, like picture larger than the Atlas that sits in front of Rockefeller Center. And their wings spread out so that essentially they touched, it was 10 amot per wing. So you had the guy on the right's wing touching one side, it came across to the back, another 10 amot to the middle of the Dvir, and then to the other side. So as you came into the Dvir, you didn't notice the little Kruvim that was sitting on top of their own. You saw Kruvim that were 20 amot high, essentially, I think about 15 amot high, and 20 amot wide. And you were put into face to face with these Kruvim. But the question is, what type of Kruvim? Okay, I think the question is, what are Kruvim? And with that, I'll end. So what are Kruvim? The classic, what would you say? What are they an image of? Is the cherub, which is a human image. What? The baby face. So the Zohar Masorah, that it's actually, it is brought down in Gemara, that is the baby face on a body of a lion, which is very similar to the sphinxes that they have. So that was a cherub. However, things go very, very strange in Yechezkel. Yechezkel seems to contradict himself. And if I could find it quickly, I'll read it to you. And it's very interesting. There are two Meiser Merkavot. Most people are only familiar with one because we only sing one during Haftarot. But there are two Meiser Merkavot in Yechezkel. One opens up the Sefer, and let me read to you how it is. Va'arba'a panim le'echad. Four faces to one. Varba knafayim lechat. And regel, the kaf regel. Where does it mention the people? Udmut pneihem. Pnei adam. So we got a human. Pnei aryeh. You got a lion. Ela yamin la'arbatam. Upnei shor, which is the ox or the bull. Like that's essentially Shevet Yosef. I want to get into that. Umismol arbatam pnei nesher. So you got an eagle. Got a human. Or actually, let me not say that. You got an eagle. You got a shor. You got the lion and you got a kruv, whatever kruv is. So we tend to think that's the face of the human. However, if we take a look at Yechezkel Yud Aleph, we've got a different situation. We've got, if I can find it right, if I can't, I apologize. I'm almost positive it's in Yud Aleph. Yeah, here it is. Please let me be able to find it. Say what Kruvim Alfani Vilmatam Kvar Hashem Hashem Baruch Nasati. Oh, come on, where is it? Oh, I'm so sorry. This is very exciting when you actually do it. Oh, here it is. Got it. It's in Yud. He talks again about the Kruvim, and it says like this. Va'arba'a panim le'echad. They've got four faces. Pnei Echad, Pnei Akruv. Pnei Asheni, Pnei Ha'adam. Hear that? Hashlishi, Pnei Aryeh, Pnei Revi'i, Pnei Anesher. So we've got the Nesher. So what are we missing? We're missing the shore. And now it starts to tie in with the whole Egel HaZahav thing, which is another shir altogether, exactly what Shevet Yosef meant to the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to the lion, which is Shevet Yehuda, and the combination of all those things. So what's the internal contradiction? So I'm not entirely sure, but I believe what was going on is he had two separate kruvim in the Beta, in the Dvir, and that's why you needed one. One of them was the image of the human, of the babies, and that's our Mesorah sitting on top. But I believe the larger ones were monitors, what we think of as monitors. They were the human shore creature, which represented a different type of servant of God above. So that in Yechezkel seems to indicate that there are two sets, with the common denominator being those always. So Kruv seems to mutate from the Adam. How do we know there's an Adam? Because in the second one, there's an Adam, right? It switches. The Kruv seems to be an Adam in the first one and a Shor in the second one. So I believe essentially he had two, and that's why there are actually two sets of Kruvim in the real Beta, in the Beta Mikdash. The ones are the smaller ones covering, and those are the little human beings, and the other ones are these big master ones, which are 15 Amot high by 20 Amot wide. Those were the Kruvim, where I guess you got a big shock as you went into the Kodesh Kodeshim on the very rare chance you had. And of course the Badim, which are the poles from the Aron, stick out to give a person a sense of the infinite. And the one last thing I'll say is, believe it or not, David built the Beit HaMikdash. Maybe some other time I'll prove it to you. He didn't do it with his hands, but he wrote the blueprints and he collected most of the money. And he actually, to a certain degree, David did get his comeuppance. He did, essentially, without actually seeing it being built, he did build the Beit HaMikdash. So that we'll have to wait for another shiur on David.